I'm going to. Seriously, Elton, you're not alone in here. When was the last time you took a bath? The old man said nothing. Come to think of it, he didn't look so great himself. Not that the standards where Elton was concerned were all that high to begin with. Sweaty and washed out and somehow not there. While Michael watched, Elton drifted a slow hand toward the surface of the counter, his fingers tapping lightly in a searching way until they alighted on the headphones, though he didn't pick them up. Are you feeling all right? Hmm? I'm just saying you don't look so great is all. Are we lights up? That was an hour ago. How asleep were you? Elton licked his lips with a heavy tongue. Flyers, what was it? Something in his teeth? Maybe you're right. Maybe I will go lie down. The old man lumbered to his feet and shuffled down the narrow hallway that connected the work area with the back of the hut. Michael heard the creak of springs as his big body hit the cot. Well, at least he wasn't in the room. Michael turned his attention back to the work that lay before him. He'd been right about the thing in the girl's neck. The transmitter was connected to a memory chip, but not any kind he'd ever seen. Much smaller and without any obvious ports except for a pair of tiny gold brads. One was linked to the transmitter, the other to the filigree of beaded wires. So either the wires were an antenna array and the transmitter ran off the chip, which didn't seem likely, or the wires themselves were sensors of some kind, the source of the data the chip was recording. The only way to find out for sure was to read the data on the chip. And the only way to do that was to solder it hard to the mainframe's memory board. It was a risk. Michael was hard soldering a piece of unknown circuitry to the control panel itself. Maybe the system wouldn't see it. Maybe the system would crash and the lights would all go out. Probably the wisest course would be to wait until morning. But by this point he was moving forward on sheer momentum, his mind clamped onto the problem like a squirrel with a nut in his teeth. He couldn't have waited if he wanted to. He'd have to take the mainframe offline first. This meant shutting down the controllers to run straight off the batteries. You could do this for a while, but not for long. Without the system to monitor the current, any fluctuation could flip a breaker. So once the mainframe was offline, he'd have to work fast. He took a deep breath and called up the system menu. Shut down? He clicked on Y. The hard drive began to spin down. Michael darted from his chair and shot across the room to the breaker box. None of the breakers moved. He got quickly to work, pulling the motherboard free, placing it on the counter under the magnifier, taking up the hot iron in one hand and the strip of solder in the other. He touched it to the tip of the iron, a waft of smoke curling in the air above it, and watched as a single drop descended toward the open channel on the motherboard. Bullseye. He tweezered the chip. He had one shot to get this right. Gripping his right wrist to keep it steady, he gently lowered the chip's exposed contacts into the solder, freezing it in place for a count of 10 while the bead of liquid solder cooled and stiffened around it. Only then did he let himself breathe. He slid the board back into the panel, locked it in place, and booted the mainframe back up. In the long minute that followed as the system came back online, the hard drive clicking and whirring, Michael Fisher closed his eyes and thought, please. And there it was. When he opened his eyes, he saw it, sitting in the system directory. Unknown drive. He selected the image and watched as the window sprang open. Two partitions, A and B. The first was tiny, just a few kilobytes. But not B. B was huge. It contained two files, identical in size. One was probably a backup of the other. Two identical files of such immensity it simply boggled the mind. This chip. It was like the whole world was written inside it. Whoever had made this thing and put it inside the girl, that person was not like anyone he knew. They did not seem to be from a world he was part of. He wondered if he should maybe get Elton, ask him what he thought. But the snores coming from the back of the hut told him this would be a waste of his energy. When Michael opened the file, as he did in due course, he did it almost furtively, one hand raised before his eyes, which were peeking through his fingers. Chapter 33. A lucky stroke. Approaching the infirmary, Peter saw a single watcher standing guard. He marched straight up the steps. "Evening, Dale." Dale's cross hung loosely at his side. He sighed with exasperation, cocking his head a little, giving Peter his good ear.
"You know I can't let you in."
Peter craned his neck to look past Dale through the front windows. A lantern was glowing on the desk. "Sarah inside?"
"She left a little while ago. Said she was getting something to eat."
Peter held his ground, saying nothing more. It was a waiting game, he knew. He could see the indecision moving through Dale's face. At last he huffed in surrender and stood aside.
"Flyers. Just be quick about it."
Peter stepped through the door and moved back into the ward. The girl was curled on the cot, her knees tucked against her chest, facing away. At the sound of his entry, she made no movement. Peter guessed she was asleep. He positioned a chair by the cot and sat with his chin in his hands. Under the tousle of her hair, he could see the mark on her neck where Sarah had cut away the transmitter. A barely detectable line, almost completely healed. She roused then, as if to meet his thoughts, and shifted on the cot to face him. The whites of her eyes were moist and full, shining in the lamplight that leaked through the curtain. "Hey," he said. His voice felt thick in his throat. "How are you feeling?" Her hands were pressed together, buried to her slender wrists in the crevice between her knees. Everything about the way she held her body seemed conceived to make her appear smaller than she was.
"I came to thank you for saving me."
A quick tightening of her shoulders under the gown.
"You're welcome." How strange it was, speaking this way. Strange because it wasn't so strange.
He had never heard the sound of the girl's voice, and yet he did not feel this as a lack. There was something calming about it, as if she had put aside the noise of words.
"I don't suppose you feel like talking," Peter ventured. "Like maybe telling me your name?"
"We could start with that if you want." The girl said nothing, indicated nothing.
"Why would I tell you my name?"
"Well, that's okay," Peter said. "I don't mind. We can just sit here." Which was what he did. He sat with her, in the dark. After a time, a slackness came into the girl's face. More minutes passed, and without any further acknowledgement of his presence, she closed her eyes again. As Peter waited in the quiet, a sudden weariness came over him, and with it a memory of a night long ago when he had come into the infirmary and seen his mother watching over one of her patients, just as he was doing now. He couldn't remember who this person was, or if, in fact, the memory was several memories, folded over one another. It could have been one night or many. But on the night, he recalled, he had stepped through the curtain and found his mother sitting in a chair by one of the cots, her head tipped to the side, and knew she was asleep. The person on the cot was a child, a small form hidden in darkness. The only light came from a candle on a tray by the bed. He moved forward, not speaking. No one else was in the room. His mother stirred, tilting her face toward him. She was young and healthy, and he was glad, so glad to see her again. "Take care of your brother, Theo."
"Mama," he said, "I'm Peter.
He's not strong like you." He was jarred by voices outside and the clatter of the opening door. Sarah strode into the ward, the lantern swinging from her hand.
Peter, is everything okay?
He blinked into the sudden blaze. It took him a moment to reassemble his sense of where he was. He had slept only a minute, and yet it felt like longer. Already the memory and the dream it had produced were gone.
I was just... I don't know.
Why was he apologizing?
I think I must have dozed off.
Sarah was busying herself with the lantern, moving a wheeled tray to the side of the cot where the girl was sitting up, an alert and watchful expression on her face.
How'd you talk Dale into letting you in?
Oh, Dale's all right. Sarah sat on the girl's cot and opened her kit to reveal what she'd brought. Flatbread, an apple, a wedge of cheese.
Hungry?
The girl ate quickly, polishing off her meal with darting bites. First the bread and then the cheese, which she sniffed suspiciously before tasting, and finally the apple, right down to the core. When it was gone, she wiped her face with the back of her hand, smearing juice over her cheeks.
Well, I guess that settles it, Sarah declared.
Not the best table manners I've ever seen, but your appetite is normal enough. I'm going to check your dressing, okay? Sarah untied the gown, drawing it aside to expose the girl's bandaged shoulder while leaving the rest covered. With a pair of shears, she snipped the cloth away. Where the bolt had entered, tearing skin and muscle and bone, all that remained was a small pink depression. It reminded Peter of a baby's flesh, that soft freshness of new skin.
All my patients should heal so fast. No point in leaving those stitches in, I guess.
Turn around so I can do the back. The girl complied, swiveling on the cot. Sarah took up a pair of tweezers and began pulling the sutures from the exit wound, dropping them one by one into a metal basin.
Does anybody else know about this? Peter asked.
About the way she heals?
I don't think so.
So nobody else has been in to see her since this afternoon. She clipped off the final stitch.
Just Jimmy.
She pulled the girl's gown back over her shoulder.
There you go, all set.
Jimmy. What did he want?
I don't know. I assume Sanjay sent him.
Sarah shifted on the cot to look at Peter.
It was kind of strange, actually. I never heard him come in. I just looked up and there he was, standing in the doorway with this look on his face.
A look? I don't know how else to describe it. I told him she hadn't said anything, and then he left. But that was hours ago. Peter felt suddenly rattled.
What did she mean by a look? What had Jimmy seen?
Sarah took up her tweezers again.
Okay, your turn.
Peter was about to say, my turn for what? But then he remembered. His elbow. The bandage had long since worn down to a filthy rag. He guessed the cut was healed by now. He hadn't looked at it for days. He sat on one of the empty cots. Sarah took a place beside him and unwrapped the bandage, releasing a sour odor of stale skin.
Did you bother keeping this thing clean at all?
I guess I forgot. She took hold of the arm, bending closely with the tweezers. Peter was aware of the girl's eyes, intently watching them.
Any news from Michael?
He felt a jab of pain as she tugged the first suture.
Ow! Be careful!
It would help if you held still. Sarah repositioned his arm, not looking at him, and resumed her work.
I stopped by the lighthouse on the way back from the house.
He's still working. Elton's helping him.
Elton? Is that so smart?
Don't worry. We can trust him. Her eyes flicked upward with a troubled glance.
Funny how we're all talking like that all of a sudden. Who can trust who?
She gave his arm a pat.
There.
Move it around a little. Balling his hand into a fist, he pumped his arm back and forth. Good as new. Sarah had stepped to the pump to clean her tools. She turned and faced him, drying her hands on a rag.
Honestly, Peter, sometimes I worry about you. He realized that he was still holding his arm away from his body. He awkwardly dropped it to his side. "I'm fine." She raised her eyebrows doubtfully, but said nothing. That one night after the music, Arlo and his guitar and everybody drinking Shine, something had come over him, a sudden, almost physical loneliness. And then, the moment he kissed her, a puncturing jab of guilt. It wasn't that he didn't like her, nor that she had failed to make her interest less than plain. Alicia was right, what she'd said on the roof of the power station. Sarah was the obvious choice for him. But he couldn't will himself to feel something he didn't. There was a part of him that simply didn't feel alive enough to deserve her, to offer in kind what she was offering him. "As long as you're here," Sarah said, "I'm going to go look in on Hightop. Make sure somebody remembered to feed him." "What do you hear?" "I've been inside all day. You probably know more than I do." When Peter said nothing, Sarah shrugged. "I expect people are divided. There's going to be a lot of anger about last night. The best thing would be for a little time to pass."
"Sanjay better think twice about doing anything with him. Leash will never stand for it."
Sarah seemed to stiffen. She drew her kit from the floor and hung it on her shoulder again, not looking at him.
"What did I say?"
But she shook her head.
"Forget it, Peter.
Leash is not my problem." Then she was gone, the curtain shifting with her departure. Well, Peter thought, what to make of that? It was true that Alicia and Sarah couldn't have been two more different women, and nothing said they had to get along. Maybe it was simply the case that Sarah blamed Alicia for Teacher's death, which would hit Sarah harder than most. It was sort of obvious now that Peter considered it. He didn't know why he hadn't thought of it before. The girl was looking at him again. She gave a quizzical lift of her eyebrows.
"What's wrong?"
"She's just upset is all," he said. "Worried." He thought it again. How strange it all was. It was as if he could hear her words in his head. Anybody who saw him talking like this would think he'd lost his mind. Then the girl did something he hadn't expected at all. Aroused by some unknown purpose, she rose from her cot and moved to the sink. She primed the pump, 3 hard pushes, and filled a basin with water. This she carried back to the cot where Peter sat. She placed it on the dusty floor at his feet and took a cloth from the cart and sat beside him, bending at the waist to dip the rag in the water. Then she took his arm in her hand and began to dab the place where the sutures had been with the moistened cloth. He could feel her breath on him, breezing over his damp flesh. She had unfolded the cloth against her open hand to increase the surface area. Her gesture was more thorough now, not a cautious dabbing, but a smooth, even stroking motion, rubbing the dirt and desiccated skin away. An ordinary kindness to wash his skin, and yet completely surprising. It was full of sensation, of memory. His senses seemed to have gathered around it, the feel of the washcloth on his arm, her breath on his skin, like moths around a flame. As if he were a boy again. A boy who had fallen and scraped his elbow and run inside, and she was washing him clean. "She misses you." Every nerve in his body seemed to jump. The girl was holding his arm in a firm grip, immovable. Not words. Not spoken words. The words were in his mind. She was gripping his arm. Their faces were inches apart.
"What did you—" "She misses you, she misses you, she misses you."
He was on his feet, lurching away. His heart was pounding in his chest like a great caged animal. He had backed with his full weight into some kind of glass cabinet, sending the contents spilling off the shelves behind him. Someone had stepped through the curtain, a figure at the periphery of his vision. For a moment his mind came mercifully into a wider focus. Dale Levine. What the hell is going on in here? Peter swallowed, trying to answer. Dale was standing at the curtain, wearing a look of confusion, his emotions unable to coalesce around any single point in the unfolding scene. He shifted his face toward the girl, who was still seated on the cot with the basin at her feet, then looked at Peter again. She's awake? I thought she was dying. Peter found his voice at last. You can't tell anyone. Flyers, Peter. Does Jimmy know about this? I mean it. He knew suddenly that if he didn't leave the room at once, he would dissolve. You can't. Then he turned, brushing past Dale, practically knocking him over. He was through the curtain and out the door and stumbling down the steps into the spotlit yard, his mind still caught in the flow of words in his head. She misses you. She misses you. His vision wavering through the tears that were rising to his eyes. Chapter 34. For Mausami Patel, the night began in the sanctuary. She was sitting alone in the big room, trying to teach herself to knit. All the cots and cribs had been taken out. The children had bedded down upstairs. The broken window was boarded up, the glass swept away, the room and all its surfaces washed down with spirits. The smell would linger for days. It wasn't any place she should have been. The aroma of alcohol was so strong it was making her eyes tear up. Poor Arlo, Mouse thought. And Hollis, having to kill his brother like that, though it was lucky that he had. She didn't want to think about what would have happened if he'd missed. And of course Arlo wasn't really Arlo anymore. Just as Theo, if he was still alive out there, wasn't Theo. The virus took the soul, the person you loved, away. The chair where she sat was an old nursing rocker she'd found in the storage closet. She'd positioned a small table beside it. Resting on this was a lantern, giving her enough light to work by. Lee had instructed her in the basic stitches, which had seemed easy enough when she'd started. But somewhere along the way she had taken a wrong turn. The stitches weren't coming out even, not at all, and her left thumb, when she tried to draw the yarn around the needle, as Lee had demonstrated, kept getting in the way. Here she was, a woman who could bolt-load a crossbow in under a second, put half a dozen long arrows in the air in fewer than five, blade a target dead through the sweet spot at 6 meters, on the run, on an off day. And yet knitting a pair of baby booties seemed completely beyond her power. She'd gotten so distracted that twice the ball of yarn in her lap had dropped to the floor to roll across the room, and by the time she'd gotten it rolled back up, she'd forgotten where she was and had to start over. Part of her simply couldn't absorb the notion that Thea was gone. She had planned to tell him about the baby on the ride, their first night at the station. With its warren of rooms and heavy walls and doors that sealed, it was easy to find an occasion to be alone there. A fact that, as long as she was being honest with herself, was the reason the whole situation existed in the first place. Pairing with Galen. Why had she done it? Cruel, in a way, because he wasn't a bad person. It was hardly his fault that she didn't love him, or even much like him, not anymore. A bluff. That's what it had been. To jar Theo out of his gloom. And when she'd said to him that night on the wall, maybe I just will marry Galen Strauss. And Theo had said, all right, if that's what you want. I only want you to be happy. The bluff had hardened into something else. Something she had to do. To prove that he was wrong. Wrong about her. Wrong about himself. Wrong about everything. You had to try. You had to act. You had to get on with things and make do. A feat of stubbornness, that's what it was, marrying Galen Strauss. And all for Theo Jackson. For a time, most of that summer and into the fall, she had tried to make the marriage work.
She had hoped she could will the right emotions into being, and for a while she had almost done it, simply because the sheer fact of her existence seemed to make Galen so happy. They were both watch, so it wasn't like they saw each other all that much or kept any kind of regular hours. It proved, in fact, pretty easy to avoid him, because he was on the day shift most of the time, a subtle but unmistakable comment on the fact that he had come up last in his grade, and with his eyes the way they were, no good in the dark. Sometimes when he looked at her squinting like he did, she wondered if in fact she was the girl he really loved at all. Maybe it was some other woman he saw, one he had made up in his mind. She'd found a way to almost never let him near her. Almost. Because you couldn't not lie with your husband. Is he tender with you? Her mother had asked her. Is he kind? Does he care about what's happening to you? That's all I want to know. But Galen was too happy to be tender. I can't believe it, his face and body said. I can't believe you're mine. Which she wasn't. While Galen huffed and puffed above her in the dark, Mausami was miles away. The harder he tried to be a husband, the less she felt like a wife to him, until, and this was the bad part, the part that didn't seem fair of her, she'd found herself actually disliking him. By the first snowfall, she'd caught herself imagining she could close her eyes and simply wish him off the face of the earth, which only made Galen try harder, and left her disliking him even more. How could he not know the baby wasn't his? Could the man not do basic math? True, she'd fudged the numbers. The morning he'd caught her throwing up her breakfast into the compost pile, she'd told him 3 periods when it was really 2. 3, and it was Galen's baby. 2, and it was not. Galen had come to her only 1 time the month she'd gotten pregnant. She had refused him on some pretense. She couldn't even remember what. No, it was all perfectly clear to Mausami, the when and who. She had been down at the station when it happened. Theo was there, and Alicia, and Dale Levine. The 4 of them had stayed up late playing hands of go-to in the control room, and then Alicia and Dale had gone to bed. And the next thing she knew, she and Theo were sitting alone together, the first time since her wedding. She began to cry, surprised at how much she wanted to, and by the sheer volume of her tears. And Theo had taken her in his arms to comfort her, which was what she wanted to, both of them saying how sorry they were. And after that, it had taken all of about 30 seconds. They never stood a chance. She'd barely seen him after that. They'd ridden back the next morning, and life returned to normal. Though it wasn't normal, not at all. She was a person with a secret. It lay like a warm stone inside her, a private glowing happiness. Even Galen seemed to detect the change, remarking something along the lines of, "Well, I'm glad to see your mood has picked up. It's nice to see you smiling." Her response, wholly absurd and nothing that could be acted upon, was a friendly desire to tell him, so he could share in her good news. She didn't know what would happen. She didn't think about it at all. When she missed her period, she gave it scarcely any thought. It wasn't like she was anything close to regular. She'd always been that way. It came and went as it pleased. All she could think about was the next trip down to the station, when she could make love to Theo Jackson again. She saw him on the catwalk, of course, and at evening assembly, but that wasn't the same. It wasn't the time and place to touch or even talk. She would have to wait. But even this, the waiting, the torturous crawl of days, the date of their next departure for the station was plainly listed on the duty roster where anyone could see it, was part of her happiness. The blur of love. Then she missed another period, and Galen caught her throwing up into the compost pile. Of course, she was pregnant. Why hadn't she anticipated this?
How had this eventuality escaped her attentions? Because the one thing Theo Jackson wouldn't want was a baby. Maybe under the right circumstances she could have won him over to the idea, but not like this. Then another thought had come to her, dawning with a simple clarity. A baby. She was going to have a baby. Her baby. Theo's baby. Their baby together. A baby wasn't an idea, as love was an idea. A baby was a fact. It was a being with a mind and a nature, and you could feel about it any way you liked, but a baby wouldn't care. Just by existing, it demanded that you believe in a future. The future it would crawl in, walk in, live in. A baby was a piece of time. It was a promise you made that the world made back to you. A baby was the oldest deal there was, to go on living. Maybe the thing Theo Jackson needed most of all was a baby. That's what Masami would have told him down at the station, in the little room of shelves that was now theirs. She had imagined the scene unfolding a number of ways, some good and some not so good, the worst of all being the one in which she lost her nerve and said nothing. The second worst. Theo guessed. Her courage failed her anyway, and she told him it was Galen's. What she hoped was that she'd see a light in his eyes come on. The light that had gone out long ago. A baby, he would say. Our baby. What should we do? What people always do, she would have told him. And that was when he would take her in his arms again. And in this zone of sheltering safety, she would know that everything would be all right, and together they would ride back to face Galen, to face everyone together. But now this would never happen. The story she had told herself was just that. A story. She heard footsteps coming down the hall behind her, a heavy, loose-limbed tread she knew. What did she have to do to get a moment's peace? But it wasn't his fault, she reminded herself again. Nothing was Galen's fault. What are you doing down here, Mouse? I've been all over. He was standing above her. She shrugged, still giving her eyes to her horrible knitting. You shouldn't be in here. It's washed down, Galen. I mean, you shouldn't be here alone. Masami said nothing. What was she doing here? Just a day ago she'd felt so suffocated by the place that she thought she'd lose her mind. What made her think she could ever learn to knit? It's fine, Gail. I'm perfectly fine where I am. She wondered if it was guilt that made her torment him so. But she didn't think it was. It felt more like anger. Anger at his weakness. Anger that he loved her like he did when she'd clearly done nothing to deserve it. Anger that she would have to be the one to look him in the eye after the baby was born. A baby that would, as long as life was being so ironic, look just like Theo Jackson and explain the truth to him. Well, he paused, clearing his throat. I'm leaving in the morning. I just came to tell you. She put her needles down to look at him. He was squinting at her in the dim light, giving his face a scrunched, boyish appearance. What do you mean, leaving? Jimmy wants me to secure the station. With Arlo gone, we don't know what's going on down there. Flyers, Galen. Why is he sending you? You think I can't handle it? I didn't say that, Gail. She heard herself sigh. I'm just wondering why you is all. You've never been down there before. Someone has to go. Maybe he thinks I'm the best man for the job. She did her best to look agreeable. Be careful, okay? All eyes. You say that like you actually mean it. Masami didn't know how to answer that. She felt suddenly tired. Of course I mean it, Gail. Because if you don't, You should probably just say so. Tell him, she thought. Why didn't she just tell him? Go on. It's all right. She took up her knitting again. I'll be here when you get back. Go to the station. You really think I'm so stupid? Galen was standing with his hands at his sides, glaring at her. One hand, his right, closest to his blade, gave a small, involuntary-seeming twitch. I didn't say that. Well, I'm not. A silent moment passed. His hand had moved to his belt, perched beside the handle of his knife. Galen? She asked gently. What are you doing? The question appeared to jar him. What makes you say that? The way you're staring at me. What you're doing with your hand. He dropped his gaze to look. A little hmm sound rose in the back of his throat. I don't know, he said, frowning. I guess you've got me there. Won't they be looking for you on the catwalk? Aren't you supposed to be there? There was, she thought, something strangely inward about his expression, as if he wasn't quite seeing her. I guess I better go, he said. But still he made no effort to leave, nor to move his hand away. So I'll see you in a few days, Mausami said. What do you mean? Because you're going to the station, Galen. Isn't that what you said? A glimmer of recognition came into his face. Yeah. I'm going down there tomorrow. So take care of yourself, okay? I mean it. All eyes. Right. All eyes. She listened to his footsteps receding down the hall, the sound abruptly muffled as the door to the big room sealed in his wake. Only then did Mausami realize that she had slid one of her knitting needles free and was clutching it in her fist. She looked around the room, which suddenly seemed too large, a place abandoned, empty of its cribs and cots. All the littles gone. The feeling touched her then, a cold shiver from within. Something was about to happen. Part 6. The Night of Blades and Stars. Swift as a shadow, short as any dream, brief as the lightning in the cullied night, that in a spleen unfolds both heaven and earth, and ere a man hath power to say, Behold, the jaws of darkness do devour it up. So quick, bright things come to confusion. Shakespeare, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Chapter 35. For 92 years, 8 months, and 26 days since the last bus had driven up the mountain, the souls of First Colony had lived in this manner. Under the lights. Under the one law. According to custom. According to instinct. In the day-to-day. With only themselves and those they had made for company. Under the protection of the watch, under the authority of the household, without the army, without memory, without the world, without the stars. For Auntie, alone in her house in the glade, the night of blades and stars, commenced like so many nights before it. She was sitting at the table in her steam-fogged kitchen, writing in her book. That afternoon she had taken a batch of pages off the line, stiff with the sun. They always felt to her like squares of captured sunlight, and had passed the remainder of the daylight hours preparing them, trimming the edge on her cutting board, opening the binding and its covers of stretched lambskin, carefully undoing the stitching that held the pages in place, taking up her needle and thread to sew the new ones in. It was slow work, satisfying in the way of all things that required time and concentration, and by the time she was finished, the lights were coming on. Funny how everyone thought she had just the one book. The volume she was writing in, by her closest recollection, was the 27th of its kind. It seemed she was always opening a drawer or stacking cups in a cabinet or sweeping under the bed and coming across another one. She supposed that was the reason she put them away like she did here and there, not in a neat line on some shelf to look at. Whenever she found one, it felt like bumping into an old friend. Most told the same stories. Stories she remembered of the world and how it was. Time to time, a bit of something would sail out of the blue, a memory she'd forgotten she had, like television, and the silly things she used to watch. Its flickering blue-green glow and her daddy's voice. "I'd turn that damn thing off. Don't you know it rots your brain?" Or something would set her off, the way a ray of sunshine drizzled over a leaf or a breeze with a certain smell in its currents, and the feelings would start to move through her, ghosts of the past. A day in a park in autumn, and a fountain billowing water, and the way the afternoon light seemed to catch in its spray, like a huge sparkling flower. Her friend Charisse, the girl from down the corner, sitting beside her on a step to show her a tooth she'd lost, holding it with its bloody stump in her palm for Auntie to see. "Ain't no such thing as the tooth fairy, I know it. But she always brings me a dollar." Her mama folding laundry in the kitchen, wearing her favorite summer dress of pale green, and the puff of scent from the towel she was snapping and folding against her chest. When this happened, Auntie knew it would be a good night of writing, memories opening into other memories, like a hall of doors her mind could walk down, keeping her busy till the morning sun was rising in the windows. "But not tonight," thought Auntie, dipping the nib of her pen into the cup of ink and smoothing the page flat beneath her hand. Tonight was not a night for these old things. It was Peter she meant to ride on. She expected he'd be along directly, this boy with the stars inside him. Things came to her in their way. She supposed it was because she'd lived so long, like she was a book herself, and the book was made of years. She remembered the night Prudence Jackson had appeared at her door. The woman was sick with the cancer, well on her way, much before her time. Standing there in Auntie's door with the box pressed to her chest, so brittle and thin it was like she could blow away in the wind. Auntie had seen it so many times in her life, this bad thing in the bones, and there was never any right thing to do except to listen and do like the person asked. And that was what Auntie did for Prudence Jackson that night. She took the box and kept it safe, and it wasn't but a month before Prudence Jackson was dead. "He has to come to it on his own." Those were the words Prudence had said to Auntie, true words. For it was the way of all things. The things of your life arrived in their own time, like a train you had to catch. Sometimes this was easy. All you had to do was step onto it. The train was plush and comfortable and full of people smiling at you in a hush, and a conductor who punched your ticket and tousled your head with his big hand saying, "Ain't you pretty? Ain't you the prettiest girl now? Lucky lady taking a big train trip with your daddy?" While you sank into the dreamy softness of your seat and sipped ginger ale from a can and watched the world float in magical silence past your window, the tall buildings of the city in the crisp autumn light, and then the backs of the houses with laundry flapping and a crossing with gates where a boy was waving from his bicycle. And then the woods and fields and a single cow eating grass. But Peter, she thought. It wasn't the train, but Peter she had meant to ride on. Only where had they been going, Auntie wondered. Where had they taken a train to that one time, the two of them together, she and her daddy, Monroe Jackson? They had been going to visit her grandma and cousins, Auntie remembered, in a place he called Down South. Peter and the train. Because sometimes it was one way, easy, and sometimes it was the other, not easy. The things of your life roared down to you, and it was all you could do to grab hold and hang on. Your old life ended, and the train took you away to another, and the next thing you knew, you were standing in the dust with helicopters and soldiers all around, and all you had to remember folks by was the picture you found in the pocket of your coat, the one your mama, who you would never see again in all the days of your life, had slipped in there when she'd hugged you at the door. By the time Auntie heard the knock, the screen opening and slapping as the person who'd come calling let themselves in, she'd almost stopped her stupid old crying. She'd sworn to herself she wouldn't do it anymore. "Ida," she'd said to herself, "no more crying over things you can't do nothing about." But here she was, all these years gone by, and still she could work herself into such a state whenever she thought about her mama, tucking that picture in her pocket, knowing that by the time Ida found it, the two of them would be dead. "Auntie?" She'd expected it would be Peter, come with his questions about the girl, but it wasn't. She didn't recognize the face floating in the fog of her vision. A squished-up, narrow man's face, like he'd gotten it jammed in a door. "It's Jimmy, Auntie. Jimmy Molyneux." Jimmy Molyneux? That didn't seem right. Wasn't Jimmy Molyneux dead? "Auntie, you're crying." "Course I'm crying. Got something in my eyes, all." He slid into the chair across from her. Now that she had found the right pair of glasses from the lanyards around her neck, she saw that he was, as he claimed, a Molyneux. That nose. It was a Molyneux nose. "Well, you won't, then. You come about the walker." "You know about her, Auntie? Runner came by this morning. Said they found a girl." She couldn't say for sure what all he wanted. There was something sad about him. Defeated, seeming. Usually Auntie would have welcomed a bit of company, but as the silence continued, this strange, sullen man she only vaguely recalled sitting across from her with a hangdog look on his face, she began to feel impatient. Folks shouldn't just come barging into a place with nothing on their minds. "I don't really know why I came by. There was something I think I was supposed to tell you." He sighed heavily, rubbing a hand over his face. "I really should be on the wall, you know."
"You say so?"
"Yeah, well, that's where the first captain should be, right? On the wall." He wasn't looking at her. He was looking at his hands. He shook his head in a way that seemed like maybe the wall was the last place on earth he wanted to be. "It's something, huh? Me, first captain." Auntie had nothing to say to that. Whatever was on this man's mind, it had nothing to do with her. There were times when you couldn't fix what was broken with words, and this looked like one of those times. "You think I could have a cup of tea, Auntie?" "You won't. I'll make you one. If it's no trouble." It was, but there seemed no escaping it. She rose and put the kettle on to boil. All the while the man, Jimmy Molyneux, sat silently at the table, looking at his hands. When the water began to thrum in its kettle, she poured it through the strainer into a pair of cups and carried it back. "Careful. It hot now." He took a cautious sip. He seemed to have lost all interest in talking, which was fine by her, all things considered. Folks came in time to time to talk about a problem. Private things, probably thinking since she lived alone like she did and saw almost no one that she'd have nobody to tell. Usually it was women come to talk about their husbands, but not always. Maybe this Jimmy Molyneux had a problem with his wife. You know what people say about your tea, Auntie? He was frowning into his cup, like the answer he was looking for might be floating in there. What's that now? That it's the reason you've lived so long. More minutes passed, a weighty silence pressing down. At last he took a final sip of tea, grimacing at the taste, and returned it to the table. Thanks, Auntie. He climbed wearily to his feet. I guess I better be going. It's been nice talking to you. Ain't no bother. He paused at the door, one hand poised on the frame. It's Jimmy, he said. Jimmy Molyneux. I know who you are. Just in case, he said. In case anybody asks. The events that began with Jimmy's visit to Auntie's house were destined to be misremembered, beginning with the name. The Night of Blades and Stars was, in fact, three separate nights, with a pair of days between. But as with all such occurrences, those destined to be recounted not only in the immediate aftermath, but for many years to come, time seemed compressed. It is a common error of memory to impose upon such events the coherence of a concentrated narrative, beginning with the assignment of a specific interval of time. That season, that year, the Night of Blades and Stars. The error was compounded by the fact that the events of the night of the 65th of summer, from which the rest descended, unfolded in a series of discrete compartments with overlapping chronologies, no single piece being wholly aware of the others. Things were happening everywhere. For instance, while old Chow was rising from the bed he shared with his young wife Constance, propelled by a mysterious urge to go to the storehouse across the colony, Walter Fisher was thinking the same thing. But the fact that he was too drunk to get out of bed and lace his boots would delay his visit to the storehouse, and his discovery of what lay there by 24 hours. What these two men had in common was that they had both seen the girl from nowhere, when the household had visited the infirmary at first light. But it was also true that not everyone who had encountered her firsthand experienced this reaction. Dana Curtis, for instance, was wholly unaffected, as was Michael Fisher. The girl herself was not a source, but a conduit, a way for a certain feeling, a feeling of lost souls, to enter the minds of the most susceptible parties. And there were some, like Alicia, who would never be affected at all. This was not true of Sarah Fisher and Peter Jackson, who had experienced their own versions of the girl's power. But in each case, their encounters had taken a more benign, if still troubling, form. A moment of communion with their beloved dead. First Captain Jimmy Molyneux, lurking in the shadows outside his house at the edge of the glade. He had yet to appear on the catwalk, a cause of considerable confusion for the watch, leading to the hasty deputizing of Sanjay's nephew Ian as first captain pro tem, was trying to decide whether or not to go to the lighthouse, kill whomever he found there, and turn the lights off. Though the impulse to perform such a grave and final act had been building in him all day, it was not until he had gazed into his teacup in Auntie's steam-fogged kitchen that the idea had crystallized into a specific shape in his mind, and if anyone had happened upon him standing there and asked what he was doing, he wouldn't have known what to say. He could not have explained this desire, which seemed both to originate from some deep place within him and yet not be entirely his own. Sleeping inside the house were his daughters, Alice and Avery, and his wife, Karen. There were times in the course of his marriage, whole years, when Jimmy had not loved Karen as he should have. He was secretly in love with Sue Ramirez, but he had never doubted her love for him, which seemed boundless and unwavering, finding its physical expression in their two girls, who looked exactly like her. Alice was 11, Avery 9. In the presence of their gentle eyes and tender, heart-shaped faces and sweetly melancholy dispositions, They were both known to burst into tears at the slightest provocation. Jimmy had always felt a reassuring force of historical continuum, and when the black feelings came, as they sometimes did, a tide of darkness that felt like drowning from within, it was always the thought of his daughters that would lift him from his gloom. And yet the longer he stood there, skulking in the shadows, the more his impulse to douse the light seemed wholly unrelated to, and hence beyond the reach of, the idea of his sleeping family. He felt strange within himself, very strange, as if his vision were collapsing. He stepped away from his house, and by the time he reached the base of the wall, he knew what he had to do. He felt an overwhelming relief, soothing as a bath of water as he ascended the ladder, which connected with Firing Platform 9. Firing Platform 9 was known as the Odd Man Post. Because of its location above the cutout, an irregularity in the shape of the wall to accommodate the power trunk, it was not visible from either of the adjacent platforms. It was the worst duty, the loneliest duty. And this was where Jimmy knew Sue Ramirez would be tonight. Though her emotions had yet to consolidate into anything more specific than a nameless dread, Sue as well had been feeling troubled all night. But these feelings, of something vaguely not right, were diffused by other, more personal recriminations. The array of disappointments brought about by being asked to step down as first captain. As Sue had discovered in the hours since the inquest, this was not an entirely unwelcome development. The responsibilities had begun to take their toll, and she would have had to step down eventually. But getting herself fired was hardly the way she wanted to do it. She'd gone straight home and sat in her kitchen and cried for a good 2 hours. 43 years old, nothing ahead of her but nights on the catwalk and the odd, dutiful meal with Court, who meant well enough but who'd run out of things to say to her about 1,000 years ago. The watch was all she had. Court was in the stables like always, and for a minute or two she wished he was at home, though it was just as well he wasn't, since he probably would have just stood there with that helpless look on his face, not moving to comfort her, such gestures being completely beyond his powers of expression. 3 dead babies inside her. 3. And he'd never known what to say even then. But that was years ago. She had no one to blame but herself. That was the worst part about it. Those stupid books! Sue had come across them at Cher, idly sifting through the bins where Walter kept the stuff nobody wanted. It was all because of those stupid books. Because once she'd cracked the binding on the first one, she'd actually sat down on the floor to read, folding her legs under her like a little in circle. She'd felt herself being sucked down into it, like water down a drain. "Why, if it isn't Mr. Talbot Carver," exclaimed Charlene Defleur, descending the stairs in her long, rustling ball gown, her eyes wide in an expression of frank alarm at the sight of the tall, broad-shouldered man standing in the hallway in his dusty riding breeches, the fabric smoothly taut against his virile form. "Whatever could you intend, coming here while my father is away?" Belle of the Ball by Jordana Mixon, The Passionate Press, Irvington, New York, 2014. There was a picture of the author inside the back cover. A smiling woman with flowing handfuls of dark hair, reclining on a bed of lacy pillows. Her arms and throat were bare. Atop her head was perched a peculiar, disc-like hat. A hat not large enough even to keep the rain off. By the time Walter Fisher had appeared by the bin, Sue had read to Chapter 3. The sound of his voice was so intrusive, so alien to her experience of the words on the pages, that she actually jumped. "Anything good?" Walter asked, his eyebrows lifting inquisitively. "You seem pretty interested." "Seeing as it's you," Walter went on, "I can let you have the whole box for an eighth." Sue should have bargained. That's what you did with Walter Fisher. The price was never the price. But in her heart she'd already bought them. Okay, she said, and hoisted the box off the floor. You've got yourself a deal. The lieutenant's lover, daughter of the South, the hostage bride, a lady at last. Never in all her life had Sue read anything like these books. Whenever Sue imagined the time before, the thought was synonymous with machines, cars and engines and televisions and kitchen stoves and other things of metal and wire she had seen in Banning but did not know the purpose of. She supposed it had also been a world of people, too, all kinds of people, going about their business in the day-to-day. But because these people were gone, leaving behind only the ruined machines they had made, the machines were what she thought of. And yet the world she found between the covers of these books did not appear so very different from her own. The people rode horses and heated their homes with wood and lit their rooms with candlelight, and this material sameness had surprised her while also opening her mind to the stories, which were happy stories of love. There was sex, too, lots of sex, and it wasn't at all like the sex she knew with Court. It was fiery and passionate, and sometimes she found herself wanting to hurry through the pages to get to one of these scenes, though she didn't. She wanted to make it last. She never should have brought one to the wall that night, the night the girl had appeared. That was her big mistake. Sue hadn't meant to, not really. She'd been carrying the book around in her pouch all day, hoping for a free minute, and had forgotten it was there. Well, maybe not forgotten, not exactly. But certainly it hadn't been Sue's intention, as things had occurred, that she should decide to make a quick visit to the armory, where alone in the quiet with no one to see her, she had pulled it out and started to read. The book she'd brought was Belle of the Ball. She'd read them all and started over, and encountering its opening passages for the second time, the impetuous Charlene descending the stairs to find the arrogant and mutton-whiskered Talbot Carver, her father's rival, whom she loved but also hated, Sue found herself instantly reliving the pleasures of her first discovery, a feeling magnified by the knowledge that Charlene and Talbot, after much hemming and hawing, would find each other in the end. That was the best thing about the stories in the books. They always ended well. These were Sue's thoughts when, 24 hours later, busted from First Captain, Belle of the Ball still stashed in her pouch. Why couldn't she just leave the damn thing at home? She heard footsteps ascending behind her and turned to see Jimmy Molyneux climbing off the ladder onto firing platform 9. Of course it would be Jimmy. Probably he had come to gloat, or apologize, or some awkward